Okay, I'd like to convene the Ways and Means Committee, and just a short announcement. It was a little hard to predict with the number of bills that we got up tonight whether we would get through the bills in a timely manner. We would, under normal circumstances, have ample time, but if you recall, we had quite a debate on what at least I perceived as rather routine bills that had passed the committee before, to get them back out onto the House floor so they could be calendared for tomorrow. And so without knowing what kind of debate we might have, just so the committee knows, I have scheduled a backup committee meeting for Friday morning, if we don't get through the agenda tonight. So just so people both on the committee and people that may be interested in some of the legislation that are in the audience. But the goal is to get done tonight, but we do have that as backup. If that helps people determine how much debate they want to have, I guess, is part of what the message is there. Representative Ruffel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And do we have the room till midnight, or do we go past midnight? What time is the...
I don't think anybody's coming in, so we can go to midnight if we had to, but I'm hoping that we won't have to do that. Much of what we're going to be doing today is like yesterday. There are issues that have passed the committee in the past, but they want to get them back up on the House floor. So we're trying to meet the floor schedule, quite frankly, is one of the reasons that we're having an early evening meeting. So that the bills can be calendared.
So, Mr. Chairman, should we have a target of midnight, or should we have a target of earlier than midnight, as was supposed to?
Well, I think looking at what happened yesterday, you can be very helpful in that regard. I would prefer not to go to midnight, but I do want to get it done. And but I'm not going to set a time certain. I'm just asking people to be cognizant of if we drag it out too much, we might have to meet Friday.
Mr. Chairman, I am but one lowly member of the political minority. I do not have this benevolent power to control members.
I understand. I don't know that I'm in any different situation than you are. But at any rate, let's get it started. If we debate too much about what the time might be, we'll be here until midnight. We'll begin with a motion by the Vice Chair, Representative Olson, about the minutes.
I move the minutes from February 17th.
Okay, the motion to approve the minutes is before us. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, then all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Yeah, the first bill then that we're taking up is the what's popularly known as the insulin bill, House File 3100 by Representative Howard. And if we could have a motion, Representative Olson. Representative Leland,
yes.
That's right. It came out of Health and Human Services.
Yes, certainly did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I move that House File 3100, the third engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seen?
Mr. Chair.
Oh, that's right. We don't need to vote yet. Yeah. I was confused that we're not adopting a division report, but the bill is before us. Okay. It takes a new session, a little time to get used to it. We do have an amendment, however, that Representative Nelson is going to move. Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the 3100A13-1 amendment. And my understanding, this amendment is to put it in line with the fiscal note that we have that they got yesterday.
Okay, so any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion carried. Representative Howard on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you, members. This is the Alex Smith Insulin Affordability Act, and many members here have had a chance to hear this bill as it's moved through the process last year and then this year as well. At its heart, this bill is about creating a safety net so that no Minnesotan loses their life because they can't afford the insulin they need to survive. We have all heard the story of Alex Smith from Nicole and James And it's heartbreaking that someone could lose their life simply because they didn't have enough money in their bank account that day to fill their insulin prescription. And since last session, two more Minnesotans have lost their life. That's why we are here today, and I'm grateful for the committee to hear this bill to move forward with the urgency this situation, this crisis deserves. In broad strokes, this bill would create a path so that eligible Minnesotans, and those are folks most at risk of rationing their insulin, would be able to get an emergency fill of insulin at the pharmacy when they need it. In addition, we would connect Minnesotans to long-term resources through a navigator to make sure that if there are existing public programs, we can secure those, get them onto those programs, and also connect them to what other affordable care options might be available to them. We are utilizing a third-party administrator to process the claims in the pharmacy level that allows us to use the existing infrastructure in place pharmacies utilize so that we can set a program up quickly and get insulin into the hands of patients when they need it. This bill is funded through a combination of public funds and a fee on insulin manufacturers. There's about $1 million in public costs that are largely to set the program up through the Department of Administration and then through MNsure. And we will have a fee on insulin manufacturers. There are just three manufacturers that control virtually the entire global supply of insulin that would be assessed this fee based on a proportion of their share of the market. The largest driver of that cost in this fiscal note is simply the cost of insulin. And happy to answer any more specific questions. Mr. Chair, it's Dan Frenny.
Okay, any questions? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howard, when you were in the Judiciary Committee, we talked about some data provisions, audit trails, and some other issues that I thought should probably be in this bill. And so were you planning on adding those in on the floor? Because I don't see them in the present bill.
Representative Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, we did add the amendments that you offered in Judiciary, and thank you for those good consumer protection amendments. I've had some conversations with this specific data set issue and don't have those specific data sets included in the bill, but happy to continue the conversation before we're on the floor, if that's what you're asking about.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Howard, could you point to me in this iteration of the bill that we have before us where those data provisions are regarding the audit trails and the role-based access, please?
Mr. Chair, I'm just glancing through here. I believe the amendment is included in a couple different places. On 9-15, we have information about data. There was a specific amendment also to the third-party contractor piece that's included.
Because I don't, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. I don't see the audit trail language in the section on 9.15 and following, so evidently it must be somewhere else because I don't see it here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, are you
from Mr. Chung? Did you get some information, or he could have come up to the table if necessary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, the amendment that we passed in Judiciary, as I understand, is incorporated. That's the extent of what's incorporated here. If there's an additional piece, but I'd like to follow up offline and make sure that we have a conversation.
Mr. Chair.
If somebody else on the committee has an answer.
Representative Leaving.
Well, thank you. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to kind of along with what Representative Howard is saying, in the Health and Human Services Finance Division, which was the last stop, we did adopt an amendment. This was, as you know, as members know, this has been one of those bills that's gone to various committees in various forms with clone bills, and we did pass a really good amendment in Judiciary, and we adopted that same amendment, I understood that it was, in our bill. So if it isn't in here, it would be a mistake, but I think it is. This has been engrossed, so it should be in here. And from there, I think Mr. Chun probably would be the best one to answer where the specific pieces of it are.
And he's just come forward, so. Mr. Chung, maybe it'd be more efficient if you don't mind. Did you hear the? I assume you heard the question because you were providing counsel.
Mr. Chair and members, I think the question was whether the language that was put in civil law is in this on data privacy. That amendment was put on, as Reps. Leaving said, in the HHS Finance Committee. I'm not sure if I can find every single piece, but for example, if you go to page 2, line 2.6, that's some of the language from the amendment. Another piece from the amendment would be on page 9, lines 10 through 14. And then there's also some data language beginning on page 9, line 15 through about line 23. So the amendment was engrossed into the bill. Okay, yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll continue to look through the bill here, but I'm still not seeing the audit trail language, but I'll keep looking.
Okay. Anybody well, right now get any guidance on that, or we'll just leave it to Representative Scott to keep looking? Okay. Any other discussion? Representative Albright.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Howard, you have two partitions in the bill. One is for an emergency supply, and as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, what is the max out-of-pocket cost to a participant in the emergency insulin side of your bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, how the eligibility is structured in this bill is that In broad strokes, what we're trying to capture is are folks that are, they have income that puts them outside of being accessible for most public assistance programs where they would have access to affordable insulin, but they're not making so much money that they can afford those large out-of-pocket costs if they're either uninsured, on a high-deductible health plan, or in some cases on Medicare. The eligibility is structured if your copay is $50 or less for insulin, you're not eligible, because the presumption is then you do have access to affordable insulin. If you are in those income ranges and your copay is $50 or greater, you could be eligible for the emergency insulin program at 500% of federal poverty guidelines. And the long-term insulin piece, we set that a little lower at 400% of federal poverty guidelines. And that's a product of working and trying to align and get bipartisan agreement with the Senate, which is where they are at in our latest discussions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howard, I understand the parameters for how the determination goes to the copay, but somewhere along the line, and I think I've heard this bill four or five times now, I haven't gotten a clear answer in terms of if you need insulin on an emergency basis, what is my out-of-pocket cost to get a 3-month or a 1-month supply of insulin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that cost would be a $30 copay for a 30-day supply of insulin. So and you're also available to access a 90-day supply of insulin, that would be $90 for that supply of insulin. So it's structured as a copay. And again, that's an area where, you know, in our, if I had it my way, I wouldn't have any copay, but in the interest of trying to come to consensus with the Senate, is where we have a copay at $30.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Representative Howard, what is the out-of-pocket cost for the long-term program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, if you qualify for the long-term program, you are receiving a monthly supply of insulin at no cost for up to a year. So how that could play out is you get your emergency refill, and then you're connected with the navigator through MinSure, who could help assess your long-term options. And let's say through that process you learn that come open enrollment I could qualify for a plan on the Minsure Exchange that would cap my copays at $0 or $25. You'd be able to get a supply of insulin. Let's say you applied in June. You'd be able to get that supply up until the next enrollment period when you can get enrolled and have affordable coverage on the exchange.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So can you walk me through the practical process that a diabetic would need to follow to receive an emergency supply of insulin? And I would appreciate understanding if there are changes to where they might have to go in order to realize an emergency supply in the environment that you described.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's a really good question and one that's sort of been at the heart of how we're structuring this bill. What we want to do is make a program that's as barrier-free as possible for the patient that allows them to access their medication how they would normally. So how this is structured, that if you are a patient and you cannot afford your next supply of insulin, you have a high deductible health plan, your out-of-pocket costs are going to be $300-$400, you're able to apply online on the Minsure website. There'll be a basic application that'll ask a series of questions to based on your eligibility and, you know, income levels, attesting that you're facing an emergency. And instantaneously, you will get a receipt, essentially, from Minsure. That's in one hand, and with that and a valid prescription, you hand that to your pharmacist, and it can be your community pharmacist where you have your insulin on file, you know, to take those two bits of information, and there you can get your emergency supply of insulin. And I just want specifically, there's the importance of this is to allow patients to access their insulin where they would normally go. We shouldn't be forcing patients to have to go to an emergency room, et cetera. That's part of this bill, is to create that network so that Minnesotans can go where they normally go, the community pharmacy, to access their medication.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You iterated two pieces of paper that someone needing to realize an emergency supply. One is this documentation from the website that's going to be run by Minsure. And the other one is a valid prescription. A valid prescription. What if they don't have a valid prescription and they just broke the last vial of insulin and it's Friday night?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, that's another very good question. The legislature, actually, this last session, one of the things we did pass was Representative Bonner's bill that if you have an out-of-date prescription, for a life necessary medication, you can get that refilled. So because of that legislation, you could get a refill. Now, if our bill is really considered with that cost barrier, if you can't access your medication because of cost, this program exists to make sure that, you know, if you're in a situation like Alec, where he had a $1,300 cost for his insulin, and he had $1,000 in his bank account. That's what this bill is aiming to alleviate. But because of the bipartisan work this last session, you should be able to get a refill in your pharmacy if you have an out-of-date prescription and in that situation, the broken vial.
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. Thank you. We are relying upon Minsure, and the fiscal note substantiates that all the participants to this program, they assume, will utilize the services of Minsure electronically. What if Minsure isn't running, as evidence to Minsure's past? Who will be liable if they can't realize that piece of paper and they die?
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, one thing I would clarify is we're not I don't want to conflate that we're requiring that Minsher build an insurance exchange, et cetera. It's really a basic form, an application, series of six questions or so that folks can file. And the other piece that the bill includes is an ability for a pharmacist to assist a patient with a paper application, et cetera, to make sure that that situation doesn't happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grapple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Howard, we received a quite extensive fiscal note on this about 24 hours ago. I'm wondering if you could highlight a couple of the points in terms of cost and relevant assumptions that members of the committee may not be familiar with.
Representative Howard. Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the piece that I would point to of note, you know, the amount that will be assessed on the insulin manufacturers in fiscal year 2021 would be $38 million. And a couple things about that figure. One, it requires that a series of assumptions be made about utilization for this program. And it is a new program. We don't know how much it's going to be utilized. The assumption in this fiscal note estimates that 70% of folks that are eligible for the program will utilize it. And clearly there has to be some sort of estimate. I'll just call out that when this bill passed the House last session, that was assumed at 25%. I submit that I believe that number is significantly higher than will be the utilization rate. However, what we've done in this bill is include language that would basically have a settle up. So in that first year, if the fee did collect too much money, we would give that money back to the drug companies. And the other thing I'd highlight about that number is the lion's share of that $38 million is simply the cost of the insulin. And that number is not the true cost to the manufacturers, because how this is structured is, you know, an insulin manufacturer may produce their vial of insulin for $7, which some studies indicate that's the cost. They will sell it at the wholesale rate for several hundred dollars. And what this bill is basically asking is that they buy back the insulin that they paid for. So the true cost of the manufacturer is significantly less than that number. Are those some of the high-level numbers that are helpful?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Howard, the biennial cost of $76 million is certainly, I mean, even by DFL standards, that's a lot of money. Do you have any comments on that, the $76 million? We have data from the Department of Health that says that we have approximately 2,800 people in the state of Minnesota who suffer from diabetes and don't have insurance. And we're talking about, and the population you're seeking to assist is substantially larger than that, but, I mean, $76 million of biennium? I mean, isn't that kind of a lot? Isn't that kind of a lot?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, one thing I would highlight for members is, again, this is a fee that would be assessed on manufacturers, not a cost borne by taxpayers. We don't believe that Minnesota taxpayers should bear the responsibility of addressing the crisis created in large part by the high cost of insulin. And in some ways, what that number reflects is the why we're all here. The price of insulin is completely unaffordable for too many Minnesotans. So to me, that's what the number reflects. Mm-hmm. It's the cost of the insulin. And as I mentioned, it won't be the true cost borne by the insulin manufacturers.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Howard, I don't know where the insulin manufacturers are supposed to get the money from. They don't have like a pharmaceutical fairy they just get the money from that dispose money on them. That comes from people who are buying medicines. Now, this is the same shift that we're seeing from the rebate side of things, where customers are paying extraordinary rates, and the insulin manufacturers aren't getting the money. We have the data on that. It's going into rebates, and it's being used to insurance companies, and those in the supply chain are gobbling up that money. But I do want to stay focused on the fiscal note. So first of all, on the fiscal note, page 15, the fourth paragraph down, it mentions the 70%. So the number that they list here, the number of eligible individuals for this program,
is it correct in saying that, so the 16,600 individuals, is that a number that you agree with, or do you dispute that number that's contained in a in this fiscal note?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, to come up with this number, you have to estimate. I would contend that that number is high for utilization, what utilization will be. A couple reasons. This is, you know, the first year we operate this program, we are going to have a lift to make sure that Minnesotans know that it's available to them. And we do include some resources for public relations and otherwise. And, you know, for a set of reasons, that number seems high to me. But again, that's why we included the settle-up language. So in some ways, the fee is going to collect what it's going to collect, and the impact's going to be who utilizes the program. And because we have that settle-up language where we'll, if the fee does over-collect, we'll pay that money back to manufacturers. And I'll mention this is kind of a first-year problem. Once we've ran the program in, after year one, we'll have a better sense of what those costs will be.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Howard, I want to be clear. When you say the number is high, are you referring to the 70% number, the 16,600 number, or both?
Mr. Chair, Representative Groffel, the 70% number.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, the 16,600 individuals, do you have an opinion on that number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, you may be referring to the 23,000. The 23,700 number is are those eligible, and we get to the 16,600 by the 70% figure. But in terms of those that are eligible, to highlight those populations, it's really the uninsured folks that are on high deductible health plans that have high out-of-pocket costs, and folks on Medicare that have high out-of-pocket costs. And, you know, again, this fiscal note estimates what those populations will be, and we have a mechanism in place with the fee to collect what we actually need.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, I just want to know if you think it's an accurate number.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I don't have as much of an issue with that number as the 70% number.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to know if you think it's accurate or not, Representative Howard.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not trying to play coy. It's just an estimate. You know, I think it's a fair estimate, but we won't know until the program actually exists and we see how many people utilize the program. And we've structured it in a way that, you know, the fee will collect what it'll collect based on how many people actually use the program. So in some ways, the estimates based on how we've crafted the bill aren't as important as making sure that we get it right at the back end.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Representative Howard, so at this point, I'd like to go to Section 1, Subdivision 3 of the bill. This is on page 2. This is the subdivision heading of eligibility requirements. And first of all, I want to, and again, I'm referencing the fiscal note as well as the bill. You're in Minnesota Care Medical Assistance. This doesn't apply to you, correct?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garofalo, yes.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, can you just explain why?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garofalo, if you're accessing care in either of those programs, you have access. You are getting affordable insulin either at no cost or very low cost.
And Mr. Chairman, you also in here specifically exclude those who are eligible under the Indian Health Services. Is that correct? And same question, why is that?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Garofalo, same answer, yes.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Howard, we also see that you have a 500% federal poverty guideline in here. Right now, is it correct or not that the 400% federal poverty level, all three major manufacturers have emergency assistance programs? Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, that's not correct. The three insulin manufacturers have some level of support for Minnesotans at that 400% level, but a true emergency program that somebody is an emergency, they walk into their pharmacy, they need a supply of insulin. Not all three manufacturers have that. I believe one as of January 1st introduced a program like that, and we've heard of a myriad of issues in the implementation of the patient assistance programs. In addition, there are segments of the population that are not able to participate in various insulin manufacturer programs, in particular in the emergency side.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Howard, with the development of this program, are you intending to replace the patient assistance programs that are currently provided by insulin manufacturers, or are you looking to supplement them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Groflo, we're looking to create a guaranteed safety net for Minnesotans. The patient assistance programs do not offer that right now. We're not saying they shouldn't exist, and we are glad that there's been some changes to them, but everything we've heard from patients are that they've got a long way to go. So with this, and I will mention that all three have different eligibility standards. They do different things different ways. This creates a uniform, accessible way for Minnesotans in need to access an emergency supply of insulin.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, supplement or replace?
Mr. Chairman Groflo, I thought that was clear from my answer, but supplement, I guess, if you want to. But the issue is what the current status quo isn't doing it. So we need a Minnesota insulin program to guarantee that Minnesotans do have access.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, if your answer is supplement, then why are you overlapping with the existing programs? Why not just say if you're not, here's your population, if they're not covered by it, then have the program assist in it? If it's meant to supplement it, why overlap it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Groflo, that is a good question. One of the challenges with the patient assistance programs are, frankly, that their credibility with patients are so low based on their past performance. And they may, on paper or on their press release, list certain eligibility pieces, and things are maybe moving in the right direction. But the patient experience, what we've heard, hasn't improved. So what we're trying to do is create a standard and create a system that we know will work for Minnesotans. And if those patient assistance programs continue to improve and continue to expand and get better, you know, this bill could go away, right? For example, the fee on manufacturers, if the patient assistance programs for the drug-free manufacturers worked well, patients knew about them, they could utilize them, they can go to those programs and this fee won't collect any money. But that doesn't exist right now, which is why we need an emergency insulin program here in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, I would say that if people lack confidence or credibility in healthcare service delivery, I'm not sure trusting MNSHR is really the way to go with it, based off of previous track record. Staying on Subdivision 3 under eligibility requirements, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there is a word here that is, to be eligible for the program, an individual must have a valid prescription. They must, for insulin. And then it says a test. They just have to attest to being a resident of Minnesota. They have to attest to not being enrolled in medical assistance of Minnesota Care and these other criteria. And so my question for you is, in the fiscal note, we've heard you talk about the out-of-pocket costs for insulin as high as, you know, $1,300 a month. If that's the case, aren't we making Minnesota just a huge welfare magnet for free insulin from other states? Why wouldn't everybody come here and get this? Because you're not requiring all you're requiring is a prescription. If you live in Hudson, Wisconsin, why wouldn't you come over to Minnesota and get your free insulin? If you lived in Fargo, why wouldn't you come to Minnesota? If you lived in Chicago, why wouldn't you make a weekend out of it? We're talking about dosages of $1,350 a month. I mean, aren't you concerned about the, once again, Minnesota's overly generous public health programs being abused by non-state residents?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, we need to make sure that we have a program that's tailored for Minnesotans, and that's what this program does. But just a couple comments specific to your question. One thing, by utilizing a third-party administrator to administer this program, we're able to prevent somebody from being able to, say, go into the CVS, get their emergency refill, and then go to a different pharmacy across the street and get another fill. Calling out this bill is for the emergency supply, you're eligible for a one-time fill in a calendar year. In talking with pharmacists, it would create quite the challenge to, you know, most people are going to go to the pharmacy where their prescription is on file. That is going to be where the lion's share, you know, barring something out of the ordinary, where people will access their medication. So, you know, most people in Chicago aren't going to have their valid prescription on file, you know, at a Minnesota pharmacy. And so we've tailored this program in a way to meet the needs of Minnesotans when they need it.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative Howard, so with regards to having a prescription on file, that's a two-minute phone call to your doctor. That's not really an issue. I mean, is there any, would you be willing to at least modify that language that the prescription had been written in Minnesota, or that some level of residency required verification? Because right now the only thing we're verifying is that there's a valid prescription. But I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that we've got, you know, take example of cigarette taxes right now. There's a very lucrative bootlegging operation for cigarettes in North Dakota right now, thanks to our excessively high cigarette taxes up here. Do you have any concerns about that being abused? That again, if all you're requiring is, hey, I promise I'm not any of these things, and here's my insulin prescription, are you concerned about other state residents misusing our program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, generally I would say in my the concept of abuse when we're talking about insulin for type 1 diabetics, I just want to call out that, you know, this is a medication that people need to live. You know, this isn't something where, and it's not because you can get it one time, it's not structured in some way where somebody with a valid prescription could come in and get this huge stockpile of insulin. And our priority is to make sure that if you're in that just desperate situation like Alec was, that you have a path to get an affordable supply of insulin.
Okay. So, Mr. Chairman, so I think that's my final question. I do think the author and I view this bill differently, but if he's looking to have a program signed into law, I would strongly encourage you to look at that word attest and to come up with something besides just having a valid insulin prescription, especially when you factor in the overall umbrella issues of high deductible plans. That is a significant financial incentive for non-Minnesota residents to come here and use that program. And I would caution you to be aware of that. Mr. Chairman and members, this is, you know, obviously it's a complicated issue. We've had a lot of things change in the last year on this issue. You know, the advocates for this were successful in getting the IRS to change the tax ruling around this as a preventative medicine. It's an incredible accomplishment. Here in the state of Minnesota, Senator Benson, who just did an amazing thing last year by slipping a provision into the omnibus bill, not a fan of omnibus bills, but it was, in this case, it worked out, where she made sure that those insulin rebates that were paid for by insulin manufacturers, that those are now for Minnesota regulated plans 100% going to the patients. The insurance companies can't use that to lower premiums or spend it on other money. And then third and finally is the large and robust expansion of these patient assistance programs, both for emergency insulin as well as for discounted insulin that have taken place. The advocates around this have gotten the IRS to take action. They have gotten Minnesota law changed, and they have been successful in getting the pharmaceutical industry to move. That's a pretty significant accomplishment. Any one of those three. The fact that all three have happened is pretty incredible. But I would just submit to members to be aware as we work on this issue and we touch it, there are unintended consequences with the best of intentions. I've highlighted the attest language and the creation of an entitlement. Just also be aware that there's a pharmacist involved in this and what we're asking of them to do and the reimbursement procedures and what they're required to keep on stock. We'll see what happens with the Senate. We'll see where you guys take this. But I do think that this is a serious issue and it merits more serious consideration. I am voting no on this bill today. Voting no does not mean that I'm in favor of people dying, as has been alleged by others. It does not mean that I'm somehow a shill for the insulin manufacturers. I'm proud of the fact that I voted for the opioid bill last year that was opposed by the pharmaceutical industry. But in this case only, the pharmaceutical industry is getting a bad rap. They're not getting the money. This is the rebates are not, the rebates are being paid for by the pharmaceutical industry. They're not getting the money. The supply chain, and this is a, you know, healthcare is such a screwed up issue, everything from top to bottom. We're picking out one single issue on it, but be aware of the fact that in this case, the people making the insulin are not the problem. That's not where the money is going. And we have exhaustive amounts of data on that. People can dispute whether it's 50 or 70%, but a significant portion of the money that's being paid by insulin customers is not going to the insulin manufacturers, and I don't think it's right to punish them when they're not the ones getting the money. So I'll be voting no. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Alter. Okay, Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Representative Howard. Is there anything that would stop a pharmaceutical manufacturer from terminating their patient assistance programs tomorrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, each of the programs actually expressly call out that they could cancel or revoke those programs at any time.
Representative Lieberly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to add a few things to respond a little bit to Representative Garofalo. First of all, on the issue of Minsure, like this, you know, oh, Minsure, the great evil thing. The reason Minsure is in this bill, is, and I was part of the work group that negotiated with the Senate over a long period of time, that was the desire of the Senate Republicans. I want you to understand that. Minsure has been doing so well and is now running things so smoothly that they wanted Minsure to do this. Now, what Minsure is being asked to do here, as Representative Howard said, is pretty limited. But that was not coming from us. That came from them. I just want you to understand that. The issue about a testing, you know, as Representative Howard said, you have to remember that this is a drug that if you don't get it when you need it, you become very ill very quickly, you rack up tremendous costs, and you can die. And we've seen that this has happened. So everything is a balance. When you set up a program, it's a balance between how much program integrity are we going to do, if you will, versus how long does that take and what hoops do people have to jump through. And so there's been a lot of consideration of how can we strike the best balance here. And, you know, no new program is perfect out of the box. I would be shocked if this didn't have to be in some way adjusted going forward in future years. But the idea of a testing is because, and this part, I have to tell you, the Senate Republicans also agreed on, that a testing is the way to go because otherwise the process is too long. When somebody like Alex Smith shows up at the pharmacy and doesn't have the money to get his insulin, it is a true emergency. And so we would rather err on the side of somebody getting something that maybe they shouldn't really be entitled to, because the thing we risk if we don't give it to them is that they will literally die. So that is the calculation that's being made here. Notwithstanding, I hear your concerns. I don't know, maybe putting in a word that it has to be we could maybe think about, I don't know if Representative Howard would be willing, but the issue about Minnesota residency, I don't know, maybe that could be handled simply. But anyway, the final thing I wanted to say is, I love how some of the Republican members are just loving on the Benson provision that is being credited with bringing down the out-of-pockets on insulin. Well, we have an answer for you. If you love that and if it really worked, we've got a bill to do that for all the drugs. So it should work beautifully for all of them if it worked for the insulin. And so you probably will be seeing that this year. And it's great, you know. I mean, if that was really the cause, and I have to tell you that's greatly disputed by a number of different people, whether Senator Benson's provision was responsible for that. But if it was, then let's do it for other drugs too, because patients are sure having a hard time paying for their pharmaceuticals, even when they have insurance.
Mr. Chairman, I was mentioned. So.
You were the one that was concerned about midnight.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, my colleague, Representative Liebling. I do think it's important to point out that what's happened in Minnesota with the Minnesota regulated plans, the $0 copays, the $25 copays, that ain't happening in any other state. Even in Colorado, where they put a cap, a hard cap on insulin copays. And so what has happened is Representative Benson, and I understand some DFLers are upset about this, but Representative Benson kind of tricked the DFL into making her point. The point was that the insulin manufacturers were not the ones getting the money. The money was going to the health plans. They were making money off of insulin and using it to lower premiums and pay for other costs. And it, to me, it seems, and again, I understand that's not the narrative. That's not what people, that people want to point fingers at the insulin manufacturers, but the results were pretty stunning. I mean, it's pretty incredible what's happened in Minnesota in the last 6 months with that one change. And with regards to your other issue regarding having that apply to all medicines, I would be 100% in favor of that.
Good.
Why would we take the rebates the medicine producers are giving? Why would we want that money to go anywhere else than to the consumers who are purchasing the medicine? It defies logic. It doesn't make any sense. But what I quibble with and what I dispute is that somehow Senator Benson's provision was just an unrelated factor. No, that's not what happened. It was one of the 10 smartest things I've seen in my 16 years of the legislature, and Senator Benson, instead of being demonized, should be credited for being bringing low-cost insulin to thousands of Minnesotans. Even testifiers who Representative Howard has invited before committees have put stacks of money on the table talking about how much it's cost and then said, well, but yeah, we get our insulin cheap now because of the MinSure plan. So I don't think she's getting the credit she deserves for it, and it is a huge change. That's it. I'm done.
Any further discussion? Representative Ebeling, would you care to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will renew my motion and just would say that nobody is, you know, if indeed this is something that is because of something that she did, great. It's great. Let's do it for all the drugs, and, you know, and I'm glad we'll have your vote on that. So with that, I renew my motion that House File 3100 be re-referred to as amended, and the third engrossment be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, motion carries.
No.
And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Howard.
Thank you, members of the committee.
The next bill is Representative Dean dealing with primary election. For president.
Mm-hmm. Good evening, Mr. Chair.
I move that House File 3068, first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register.
The motion is before us. Representative Dean, here to explain the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3068 put some guardrails around something that we did a couple of years ago, and that was we moved from the caucus system for our preferences for the presidential nomination to an actual primary that will be conducted by the state of Minnesota. Through the process since that time, excuse me, I'm losing my voice. I think many of us were under the understanding that the information that would be provided to individuals, particular parties, who the party that they chose the ballot to vote for in the presidential national primary. Subsequent to that, at the end of last year, there was some determinations that no, this information had to be available to all parties, to all four of the major parties. What this bill does is it requires that the major national parties' political committees need to request the information from the Secretary of State. It has to be in writing. And through that process, they actually enter into contract with the Secretary of State and what that can be used for. This makes it very clear that the use of this information is only to verify the party participation of those individuals, and any other use would be subject to data privacy protections in 1308 and 1309. In addition, this bill would make it so that individuals could actually opt out of their name being included in the data set that may be provided to parties. Mm-hmm. The bill has gone through three committees and has had some robust conversation, but I think we've talked through most of it. And if anything, I would say there might be some slight changes that might come from the floor relative to issue about possible neglect or willful neglect on the part of the party should that data be not secured by them and somehow get out there. Yeah, I think that's the substance of this bill.
And reminding members, so we had a busy night, this Ways and Means Committee, and so what's the fiscal impact?
Well, the fiscal impact shows about $8,000 in cost, but the Secretary of State said that they will be able to absorb that cost.
Okay, so that's important to remember. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Representative Dean. I feel like we have deja vu all over again from this morning, but I just want to make some comments on this bill. I'm not going to really ask any questions because they were already asked this morning, but some of the concerns here this morning in the Judiciary Committee had to do with just the safety of the data in the first place, whether it should be collected at all. I have a bill that says the data that's already been collected needs to be purged, and going forward, you know, if we pass the my bill early and fast, then none of the other which party you preferred their ballot for would not even be collected. And so anyway, we discussed some of that. We discussed the safety of the data, because once it leaves government's hands, even if it's going to one person at the state party or one person at the national party for the Democrats and one person at one for Democrats, one for Republicans, and only one person on each side, it's still left the hands of our government, and therefore, even though the bill says that they're subject to our data practices laws, and the reality of it is that we lose control over that. And it's going to be really mighty hard to determine if there's a data breach, who's responsible for it. And we also talked this morning a little bit about the fact that if a person felt that the data got out there wrongly and they wanted to bring an action, that it's at their expense, and they would have to do a very detailed investigation, a very expensive investigation, some that I don't even understand as far as technical aspects of it, and getting into if all of this is sent electronically, following that the audit trails and so forth, if there are any, and there aren't any in this bill, it would be very difficult for anyone wanting to bring an action to actually do so and prevail. Number one, just because of the expense of going to court to make it happen. So when this bill was passed in 2016, on the heels of a very sort of chaotic in both parties' caucuses, we thought, you know, let's do what the people are asking for us to do. Let's have a presidential primary. And Representative Garofalo brought up on the floor that day, and Representative Liebling and some others I know spoke in favor of his amendment that said we should not be collecting this party preference data. That is not something that should be collected. It's gonna cause people not to show up and vote. And so once it became public around this bill that was gonna happen, so many people were contacting, I'm assuming probably everyone around this table was contacted by someone in their constituency that said, please don't do this, I'm not gonna vote if I have to tell my party preference and it's gonna be saved and sent to who knows where. So that the amendment obviously failed. I did vote on the prevailing side. I voted for the bill, the presidential primary bill, without that. But one of the things that we need to keep in mind as we're legislators here is that when we hear from the public about something like that, we need to be able to pivot and we need to be able to change our actions if we can. And there's still time before March 3rd to pass my bill, make sure that no further party affiliation data is collected. And that's what I think that we ought to do. I think there are issues still with the security of this data with this bill. And I appreciate Representative Dean and the Secretary of State and others trying to make it better. But I think there's still a lot of risk in doing what this bill does. And so I will be a no vote. Thank you.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Olson.
I renew my motion that House File 3068 be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Lee. We'll now go to House File 8. And this is the one where we now are adopting a division report. So, Representative Olson, please do the division report.
Sure. I move the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division Report for House File 8.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Representative Olson.
I move that House File 8, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, that motion is before us. Where is Representative Pinto? I assume he was here. I talked to him.
This looks like
we can't
take the bill
off.
We're done for the night.
He's coming. Oh, I can.
Stop him.
I'm sure I'll do this.
There he is.
Oh, Representative Pinto, welcome to the committee. We've passed two motions. care to know the status of your bill.
Not going well.
Okay, good.
We've too serious.
Okay, fair enough. That was
no. Where we're at is we've adopted the motions to put the bill appropriately before us, and we're at the point where the author explains the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I might ask the pages. Maybe I actually don't have a copy of the amendment that will be in front of you. I know that there is an author's amendment. And as we do that, I'll just remind members. Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 8, the bill before you, is the bill. Thank you. Is the bill for criminal background checks.
Do you want to take the amendment and get the bill in the order that
if, you'd yes,
like?
If,
I think that would be more appropriate at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Olson, you want to move the amendment?
I'll move the A21 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us. And if Representative Pinto, if you could explain the amendment.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. Members, the A21 puts the bill in substantially the form that was in when it passed off the House floor, this proposal, when it did as part of the Public Safety and Judiciary budget last spring. And so it simply makes some conforming changes to substantially match to the language that passed the House.
Okay, so that motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Now the bill as amended is before us, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, so members, House File 8 is the bill to require criminal background checks on the transfer of certain firearms in Minnesota. We've discussed, I think members are very familiar with this issue. A reminder that we are have an epidemic at which Americans, Minnesotans die from guns at rates far higher than any country in the world we wish to compare ourselves to. At the same time, there are, as we know, millions of Americans, hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans who use firearms responsibly for hunting, for sport, as a hobby, et cetera. And members, we can do more to keep guns out of the hands of people who have demonstrated themselves to be dangerous and at the same time uphold the rights of those many, many Minnesotans. And the two bills before you, both House File 8 and House File 9, that you'll be hearing, do exactly that. And this is a bill to simply require that when a firearm is transferred, that we know the person receiving it is eligible to receive it, is not a violent felon or other category that is already under our law prohibited from possessing a firearm.
And Representative Pinto, being that you're before the Ways and Means Committee, if you'd comment on the fiscal question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an unusual point, members. There is no cost to this bill. The reason it is before Ways and Means is because it was referred to committees under the previous system in 2019, under which it went to Ways and Means, then to committees below Ways and Means. It had to come out that same way. But if the bill had gone out this session, it would not be in front of Ways and Means because there is no cost to it. So you can let that guide your discussion as the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, and I was just informed before we go to discussion, Mr. Sullivan, was there a technical problem that you picked up?
Mr. Chair,
it's members, with the amendment, I understand.
I believe so. The amendment updated one of the effective dates in the second engrossment of House File 8 on page 4, line 3. It changed the effective date from August 1st, 2019 to August 1st, 2020, but that date appears also in the second engrossment on page 12, line 5. So I think, if possible, and Mr. Marks just found it also on page 8, line 27, and that's also not in the amendment that was adopted. So to update all the dates to 2020, there would need to be a change on line 12.5 and on line 8.27.
Maybe you can make sure that's written down so that the committee clerk gets that for the committee report. I think we've got it, but just in case. Okay, that's a technical amendment then, so I'll move the amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion carried. Any discussion on the bill? Representative David.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you kind of give us more time to say no? Could you give us more time to say no? You're awfully fast on the no. Please.
Are you talking about the last vote?
Take the vote?
Yeah, very fast. You don't want to say no.
I've been just listening to the minority lead. He wanted to be out of here early, so but I'll take your advice to heart. Yes, okay. My intent wasn't. I kind of knew the direction of the bill, but at any rate, you make a good point. Any discussion beyond the request by Representative Davis? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, just to help members make a basis for the decision of this bill, certainly it's a fiscal committee, but is it your personal belief that the right to own a firearm is tied to being a member of a militia, or do you have an individual right to own a firearm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Garofalo. So, Representative Garofalo, as you're, I think, aware, the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, under the Heller case, made very clear that restrictions such as this are quite consistent with the Second Amendment, and this sort of proposal is in use, these provisions in use all around the country. And so I think members can feel very comfortable and approving the same sort of provisions that are in use in states with Republican legislatures, Republican governors, et cetera.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, answers exactly like that are why people like me get suspicious of bills like this. Because it's a pretty cut and dry answer. I mean, the Supreme Court has ruled that you have an individual right to own a firearm. It would seem that this would be a valid thing to affirm to say, yes, I recognize an individual's right to own a firearm. But that's the problem. We have one major political party in this country that thinks it's their prerogative and their right to tie that individual right to being a membership in a militia, which is an assault on my and every single individual's Second Amendment rights. It's a ridiculous proposition. It'd be like suggesting the First Amendment only applies if you own a newspaper. It's silly. Representative Pinto, do you have the votes on the House floor to pass this bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Garofalo, I hope that we'll earn your support, and with that, I'm quite confident that with that and many others that we will.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, hell no, not a chance, no way. Mr. Chairman, I would request a roll call on the House File 8 and ask that members vote no.
Okay, request for roll call is noted. Any further discussion? Seeing none then, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Drazkowski?
No.
Representative Eklund?
No.
Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Hausman?
Yes.
Representative Hertas? Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Kreisha?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Neuer?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Torkelson?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes.
The motion carries 16 to 13. So bill is passed. It's the next, thank you, Representative Pinto. The next bill before us, I'm looking now to make sure that Representative Richardson is, yeah, there she is. I was moving rather quickly on the last one, so I wanted to make sure that we had the author present, so welcome to the Ways and Means Committee. Representative Olson.
I move the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Division report for House File 9.
Okay, the motion is before us. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion?
No.
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 No. No. Carried. I'm taking advice from the tax, former tax chair, tax lead, I was about to say. Okay, so Representative Olson.
I move that House File 9, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, the motion is before us. And we do have an amendment. Representative, I think we'll get it in the order that with the amendment, so it'll be in good order when we present it. Representative Olson.
I move the A24 amendment.
Okay, the motion is before us. And Representative Richardson, would you care to explain the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Chair. So the A24 amendment would get the bill in substantially the same pattern that was passed off the House floor last year.
Any further discussion then on the amendment? Get it in the order that the author would like. All those in favor then signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
No?
No.
The motion carried. I take advice.
You're out of your rhythm.
That's right. Okay, if you could explain the bill. Oh, wait, we've got the technical amendment. That's right. Yeah, that we had advice from the reviser, so we've got another technical amendment here. And maybe we can just explain the technical part of it, Mr. Sullivan.
Mr. Chair and members, the A20-0628 amendment is similar to the amendments the committee considered on and adopted on Monday that were necessary due to the fact that one of the statutes in the bill was amended last session. So in order to amend the current version of that language, this amendment would insert the 2019 supplement version of Section 624.713, Subdivision 1.
And this one comes, members, from the reviser's office, and so... the chair will move the amendment. Any discussion or questions? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 No.
Opposed?
No.
No. No.
Motion carried. Okay, now we'll explain the bill.
Thank you, Chair. House File 9 is a proposal to help keep guns out of the hands of people who are at risk of harming themselves or pose a danger to others. The bill would create a process by where law enforcement or a city or county attorney can petition the court to have an individual's right to possess a firearm without for a temporary period. I have a few high-level comments related to the costs anticipated with the implementation of the bill based upon the fiscal note review. Overall, there would be a fiscal impact from the general fund of $231,000 for fiscal year 21 and $248,000 in fiscal years 22 and 23. Quick breakdown, filing fees would be waived for both petitioning law enforcement agencies, city and county attorneys, and also for respondents as well. There are some anticipated court costs. The costs related to creating the necessary forms have been absorbed. There's some configuration costs that have been anticipated on the judicial branch case management system, and those costs are also expected to be absorbed by state court administration. In regards to new case filings, the fiscal note relied on using comparable data on domestic abuse cases, and based on the estimates project that one additional FTE would be required for statewide implementation, and that would be at a cost of $43,000 in fiscal year 21 and $86,000 for fiscal years 22 and 23. There are some minimal costs anticipated with the post board related to creating best practices and recommendations and on the storage of firearms, and those costs would be absorbed by the post board. There's a grant program that is anticipated that public safety would administer for capital resources that may be needed for storage for local agencies, and that bill would appropriate $100,000 to public safety for that purpose. Finally, there were some costs related with modifying the query records that law enforcement uses to determine if an individual is disqualified from having a firearm, and that would be at a cost of about $187,000. The work to add the criminal offenses to statute services would be absorbed, and there'd be ongoing maintenance for functionality at $37,500 annually.
Any discussion? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Richardson, I know you probably don't have a copy of this letter before you. I received this from a former constituent that now lives in Roseau, but she contacted me, and I got this email late today. And she's a woman that survived abuse, and later her abuser went on to commit even worse crimes that are spoken of in this letter. But I want to draw members' attention to the paragraph on the bottom of the first page, and starting with the second sentence. Well, I'll start at the first. So I urge you to stop this madness and do not create any new gun laws. They will only limit my ability to own a gun and only hurt law-abiding citizens. As you know, many women like myself suffer from PTSD, depression, and anxiety because they've been abused. I fear that if you pass the universal background check law, I will no longer be able to own a gun. Furthermore, red flag laws are just constitutionally wrong. So I think one of her concerns is that because she has suffered from some mental issues, probably is on antidepressants or something, that through a law like the red flag law that could prohibit her from having a firearm. And so I don't think that that is a good strategy or is in the best interest of public safety when someone has a firearm to be able to defend themselves, and especially someone that has this past history and feels very vulnerable, and the firearm allows them to have some sense of security. And so that is one of the reasons that I can't support your bill this evening. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Skowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the bill, Representative Richardson. You know, I noticed and I listened to your discussion. I've never seen this before. We're waiving filing fees for this bill. We're waiving the need for them to make application within the legal process. You're greasing the skids to put people into this program. I haven't seen this before. The Democrats of Minnesota are so gung-ho to take our guns that they're going to grease the skids in this bill to get people into this program. Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, what do we do? You've got a section in the amendment that talks about liability protection for harm following service of an order of execution of a search warrant. So what it's saying is that basically the government isn't liable for damage that the police do when they break down the door and they engage a person and attempt to take away their firearm. Where is the liability protection for the police officer? Because we're going to eventually lose a police officer from these bills. We know what happened in Maryland when a guy died when they broke the door down. We're sending police officers into a situation where we're going to take a firearm away from a law-abiding citizen who may be very, very protective of their Second Amendment rights. Got government causing a conflict. Government is going to cause damage with this bill. Government is going to hurt people with this bill. They're very likely in the long term will be people killed by this bill. So what do you have to say to that, Representative Richardson?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My response to that would be to look at the research that has been made available on red flag laws. Red flag laws go back 20 years in the United States. The first red flag bill was passed in 1999 in Connecticut. And between 1999 and 2013, there were 762 orders enacted in Connecticut that didn't have a similar result of what you talked about that happened in Maryland. I would also point to the fact that there have been a lot of lessons learned, as we now, I believe, have 18 states that have adopted red flag laws. And some of the really important, I think, best practices have come from cities like San Diego, who over a year period had 189 orders. And of those 189 orders, 188 of those, they worked directly with the individuals in a way that didn't involve breaking down a door in order to work with them in the enforcement of an order. And so my response would be that in terms of thinking about how law enforcement is responding, there are ways of de-escalating conflict that don't necessarily involve breaking down a door in the middle of the night.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Richardson. Well, you know, out of the example you used, one door got broke down, it sounds like. We know that one person got killed in Maryland. If we are bringing forward a bill that we knowingly expect is going to cause a confrontation that someone could get hurt or killed, I don't think we're being responsible as a legislature. Members, I encourage a no vote on this bill. I think it's irresponsible for us to do this to the people of Minnesota and to the fine law enforcement people who are out there working to do their job each day.
Representative Greffel.
Mr. Chairman and members, as with House File 8 before this, House File 9 is an attack on individual freedom and personal liberty. It is unfortunate that, again, at a time when we see greater concern about individual freedoms and personal liberties, that we are seeing a major party that is so committed to taking away our constitutional rights. In this case, what it does is it makes the lawful gun owner, it puts them in a position of being a presumption of guilt. That's wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. The reality is that when it comes to the matters of our Second Amendment, the concerns that you're seeing expressed by so many people are absolutely justified. The fear that many of us have about government coming for our guns are justified. And it's justified in the rhetoric we see of the political left, it's justified in the candidates that are coming forward, and it's justified by the bills that are being advanced in the legislative process. I would hope that this chamber lacks the votes to pass this bill. I'm confident that it will not become law with the help of the Senate blocking this and defending our Second Amendment rights. But I'm also very optimistic about the future. Regardless of how the November elections happen, I don't see any scenario where a majority of members of both the House and the Senate will stand and take away individual rights, our Second Amendment rights. We see this as now the advancement of this bill. We're seeing a pushback now from our local communities where three counties, or maybe even four counties, have now passed sanctuary resolutions for their counties. From a political perspective, I love it when the DFL talks about gun control. I absolutely love it. For 30 years plus, whenever you guys bring forward gun control, you get absolutely wiped out at the ballot box in November. I love it. But as an individual citizen, I am concerned that a major party continues to attack my individual freedoms. I would ask members to vote no.
Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
I heard a voice. Oh.
I would request a roll call vote.
Roll call has been requested. Gosh, and I don't get to do my more my slower approach to calling for the no votes. I just announced the total.
All right.
Okay, are we ready?
All right.
Yeah, we should have the motion to renew your motion first.
I'll renew my motion that House File 9, as amended, be recommended to be placed on the General Register.
Okay, that motion is before us. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will take the roll.
Representative Carlson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Albright?
No.
Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Representative Davids?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Juskowski?
No.
Representative Eklund?
No.
Representative Hamilton?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Representative Hausman?
Yes.
Representative Hertas? Representative Hornstein?
Yes.
Representative Kreisha?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Yes.
Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Long?
Yes.
Representative Mariani?
Yes.
Representative Marquardt?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Noor?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski?
Yes.
Representative Poppy?
Yes.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Torkelson?
No.
Representative Vogel?
No.
Representative Lugenius?
Yes.
Okay, the motion passes 16-13. Thank you, Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Chair.
And we'll now take up Representative Poppy's bill, House File 141. And Representative Poppy, would you care to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 141 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Okay, the motion is before us. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill was introduced and heard this past year. It's heard in Government Operation, the Jobs Committee, and in Ways and Means, but it has no fiscal impact. It is a bill that allows port authorities, whose function and authority is economic development, to sell property at the same threshold as a city, so with a simple majority. I've been asked to carry this by my city in Austin, but there are five cities that would like to see this happen: Austin, Bloomington, Wadena, Albert Lea, and Redwood Falls. I ask for your support.
Okay. The any discussion? Seeing none, care to renew the motion?
I'd like to renew my motion that House File 141 be recommended to be placed on the general register.
Reminded, I get to make a very positive announcement after we're done with your bill. Any further discussion? Seeing none, then all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Nice announcement is that, one, we didn't go to midnight. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Garofalo.
Thank the committee for a good debate, but we did it in a timely manner. And the meeting, the good announcement is the meeting on Friday is canceled. There's no need to meet. That was just back up in case things got drawn out. So everybody will appreciate that. And anything else? Okay, with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you, everybody.